For the week of June 7th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 282, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How y'all doing?
Oh, wow. Okay, so now I thought maybe you were having that, a bit of that accent because you were so happy that, you'd watched the Triple Crown and, of course, American Pharoah won the Triple Crown, first time since 1978 that a horse was able to win the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes. And I wonder how much this is followed overseas.
Well, horse lovers do, but I mean, what's that got to do with a Southern accent?
I don't know. I was just thinking Kentucky Derby, really. I know
that's a different accent.
That's true. And as is the French accent, the French Open was. If you were Longinus, by the way, the watchmaker, you had a great weekend, or you had a very expensive weekend, because all of the people associated with the Triple Crown winner got Longinus watches. Okay, and during the ceremony, you saw all the Longinus watches, and likewise. They sponsor the French Open, and so the winners get Longinus watches. So
you think they'll be all right?
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
I'd rather get a Tony Award.
Oh, well, guess what? On this week's show, we're actually going to be telling you how a musical based on a graphic memoir, and get this, it's about family, memory, sexuality, and suicide, how that particular show won the Tony Award for Best Musical on Sunday evening, while the play for the ridiculously long title, it has a ridiculously long title, it's about a boy with Asperger's syndrome, that took home the Tony Award for Best Play. They both sound interesting, or quite possibly depressing.
He doesn't actually have Asperger's. They don't identify. He's on the spectrum somewhere of autism, but we don't know what he has.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't seen the show. I take it
or you read the book, apparently. And nonetheless, get your facts right.
Oh, geez. You know, I was going based on what the New York Times said.
They did not say he had Asperger's, did they?
Yes, they did. In their coverage, they did mention the word Asperger's.
Then they're wrong.
That's how I knew how to spell it, in fact. But, you know, Michael, as we record right now, as we are recording this show, Apple is in the midst of announcing a streaming music service that some believe might be the tipping point that could save the music industry. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We got our info from RentTrack. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We pull it from a bunch of other sources. And the number one movie is, of course, San Andreas. Another $125 million. It's just under $300 million worldwide. It's a big hit, even in 3D, and even in California.
Yes, I guess I was kind of looking up some information. It turns out the top theaters, 19 out of the 20 top theaters for San Andreas were in San Francisco and LA during its opening weekend. So the top 20 grossing theaters were all on the West Coast, except for one, which was in New York.
Right, so we're talking about North American grosses for this movie because it's opened around the world. But yes, in North America, and that's insane. That never happens.
Yeah, well, Dan Feldman, the head of domestic distribution for Warner Brothers, said, that exactly what you just said. It never happens. And he then was quoted as saying, some of the naysayers said people living in these places would be too scared to see San Andreas. Obviously, they were wrong.
And number two around the world is Melissa McCarthy and her comedy Spy. This grossed $55 million. It just opened in North America. And it's already opened overseas in a few territories. What am I talking about? About 54 territories. It's made $86 million worldwide. It's off to a strong start. Like Kevin Hart, she's been churning out comedies, and every one of them seems to be a hit. But this actually is getting good reviews, and that's a nice change of pace for Melissa McCarthy.
Well, what about Heat? Did Heat not get good reviews?
I thought the Heat was the other one that got decent reviews. This got much better reviews. Then we had Tammy, and we had... what was the other one? There was another one, the Identity Theft. Those got really brutally bad reviews, and it felt like she was churning them out. This one has a funny poster. It's getting pretty good reviews. So it's probably her best reviewed since Bridesmaids, I would say.
And I would say keep working with Paul Feig.
Well, they are. They're besties.
Yes.
Number three around the world is Insidious Chapter 3, another $37 million. It's at $166 million worldwide. And number four is Tomorrowland, the George Clooney thing from Disney. $20 million it made around the world. It's at $170 million, which is about what it costs to make.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There was an article about Robert Iger, the CEO of Disney, in the LA Sunday Times, or the Sunday LA Times. And they were talking about some of his big wins, such as buying Pixar and Marvel and now Lucasfilm, and some of the, not everything works like The Lone Ranger. And then they threw in Tomorrowland. And I thought, well, I guess we're calling that a disappointment now.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's unlikely it'll pull up all it needs to do worldwide just to get to profitability.
I mean, and don't you think it's rather risky, though? Because Tomorrowland is a whole like little world inside of the Disneylands and the Disney Worlds, that they all of their theme parks. So if it fails, couldn't it have affected the Disney theme parks? I guess not.
If it was more intimately linked to it, perhaps, but since it's practically just like the name, really, it's not like you're at the park playing around in tomorrow. You know, it's really more just a vague link, I think, than anything. I mean, you know, the Eddie Murphy film Haunted Mansion, that didn't stop people from going to the Haunted Mansion. But you're right. I suppose there is some small risk if it could be so hatefully bad that makes people think the park is uncool or that land is uncool. But I don't think that's going to happen here. It barely feels like it's linked to the park anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's linked, graphic design-wise and design-wise, but other than that, there's nothing there.
Yeah, and number five around the world is the best-reviewed movie in the top 10. It's Mad Max Fury Road, another $18 million. It's at $315 million and counting. It, too, has a ways to go before it hits profitability, but at least it's on strong footing as far as the reviews and where it should do well in the afterlife after the box office. It should be a strong movie on DVD and Blu-ray, strong streaming, strong in all those other categories.
Well, and by earning so much money now, of course, when all those...
Well, it hasn't yet.
Well, $314 million worldwide.
Right. It's cost $150 million to make, so it needs to gross at least $450 million before we can say this is a success, right?
Well, a break even theatrically, yes. What I mean by that is when you earn, let's say, what they've earned $130 million in the U.S., alone, you can then start to say, well, the output deals will start kicking in at 25%. So instead of earning, you know, if it had only earned $50 million, they might only earn a percentage of that from the output deal. Now they're going to earn at least $25 million from the U.S. alone, maybe on the output deal. That's not bad.
All right. And number six around the world is Entourage, a movie I do not have a budget figure for. I don't know how much this cost to make. I assume it wasn't much. And you better hope so. It made $13 million. It's at $20 million worldwide and counting, most of that in North America. It's just opened in a few territories. I don't think it really has any visibility overseas, as far as I know. The TV show, I don't think, was a big worldwide hit. I'm just making that up. I don't really know that, but it doesn't seem like it traveled a lot like, say, Sex and the City did. But maybe there's some story there. I don't know. We'll find out as it opens up in more and more territories. But it's at $20 million worldwide. We don't know what it costs to make. It got middling reviews and a lot of criticism for opening on Wednesday. People think if it's a big front-loaded movie where you've got a lot of hardcore fans, like a horror film, or something like Entourage, where you know there's going to be a core 1 million or 2 million people who are really eager to see it, don't open on a Wednesday, because then you've lost your steam by the time you get to Friday. You're not going to win that weekend, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And I don't necessarily know. I don't know what their thinking was here, other than trying to maybe get people into theaters on a Wednesday.
Well, maybe they just thought, you know what, we can't compete on the weekend. There's not actually that much demand. So open on a Wednesday when you're the only game in town. You know, and really, there's no such thing as a Friday opening anyway, is there? Movies open on Thursday now. We should start acknowledging this. Movies do not open on Friday. They open Thursday night at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, that used to be that you would open on a Friday, and you might, if you were a big film like a Harry Potter, you'd have a midnight screening. Well, those midnight screenings...
That's a pretty recent phenomenon, right?
Right, over the last 10 years.
That's only like the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it was like, well, let's make it 8, because it's a kid's movie. So now it's Thursday at 8. You can't show it before then, but it opens Friday, kind of, but Thursday. And what that does is it front-loads Friday. So all of a sudden Friday will have this major, you know, huge box office, and it will make it look like a 3-day weekend did much better than it could. The only other thing,
it's a 3.5-day weekend.
Right. The only other thing I could think of with Entourage is that they thought the reviews would be so bad that if they open on a Wednesday, all the reviews would be printed on Tuesday and nobody would see them. But that is, if that's true, then they're, you know, not.
They're living in the past, because that's not how people get their reviews anyway.
Exactly.
But truly, movies open on Thursdays now. They do not open on Friday. They open Thursday night. That's true for, it's not just for big movies. It's every movie opens on Thursday.
I don't know about every movie. I don't know if
not a tiny art film, not a documentary, but a big Hollywood movie.
Oh, yeah. Big Hollywood movie, absolutely opening on a Thursday.
Spies, every film in our top 10 opened on Thursday. Oh, and that is now the new normal, isn't it?
Yes, I would say so, yes. I mean, it's certainly the majority of them.
So it gets silly to compare a weekend box office on Friday to Sunday if you're comparing it to something that opened 20 years ago, when it doesn't include the Thursday box office.
That's right.
So you got to put an asterisk by everything. At number 7 around the world is The Avengers, Age of Ultron. No need for an asterisk for this. It's at $1.348 billion worldwide. $1.348 million. It's slowing down now. It grossed $13 million this weekend. It's opened everywhere. And this is a huge, huge hit.
Is it, now, course, my question
it cost
is,
a lot to make.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
And number 8 is Stand By Me, Dora Eamon. That grossed $12 million. It's now at just about $150 million worldwide. All of it in Japan, I believe. Hopefully it'll come to the U.S. sometime soon. And number 9 is Pitch Perfect 2. That's about to hit $250 million worldwide. And number 10 is the cheapy Poltergeist reboot. That is at $68 million worldwide. And at number 11, a film its filmmaker has now apologized for, sort of, is Aloha. Directed and written by Cameron Crowe. It's grossed $17 million. Its reviews have been essentially boiled down to, how dare you? How dare you? I think that's the basic reviews for the film. And did he really apologize? What's going on there?
I guess he wrote an essay because, you know, when you're a former journalist, that's what you do. You don't just kind of like tweet something out. You write an essay and you put it on your blog there or your website. And he said, thank you so much for all the impassioned comments regarding the casting of the wonderful Emma Stone and the part of Allison Ng. Or I don't know how you pronounce her last name.
Certainly don't.
Apparently, I don't know how. And you've just heard the result of that. He writes, I have heard your words and your disappointment, and I offer you a heartfelt apology to all who felt this was an odd or misguided casting choice. He then went on.
In other words, he didn't apologize.
Yeah.
He said, I'm sorry you feel bad, which is fine. And he said, look, it's based on a real person. She's redheaded. She doesn't look like everybody else. And she always felt this sort of weight about explaining her heritage. He's like, no, I am part Hawaiian. And so that's the point of the character. The problem is that didn't come across well enough in the movie. And so it just looks stupid that Emma Stone was cast as her. And he's like, hey, she's great. Don't blame her. Blame me. That was the role. That's the character, a person who doesn't look Hawaiian. Therefore, you cast someone who doesn't look Hawaiian. So he says, leave her alone.
You know, good for him that he's actually, you know, acknowledging it, I suppose. I don't necessarily know that it needed to be acknowledged. Did it?
Why not?
Okay. Well, I have a question for you, because when I read this next story
I'm excited. I can't wait. I'm looking forward to seeing it in 3D. Always said, there are always certain movies done really well, passionately, carefully, where you say that makes sense for 3D. I'll see the next Avatar in 3D, even though I didn't really like the first one, but I will see it in 3D and I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. Well, I wish I could like just kind of segment out that little part where you said, and I'm looking forward to seeing it in 3D. I would just like have a button where I could press that whenever, 3D.
Like a morning zoo show.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. At least here in the U.S., the morning zoo would have, you know, a little cowbell and that little sound effect. What we're talking about is the New York Film Festival. And what we're talking about in regards to the New York Film Festival is that The Walk, which is directed by Robert Zemeckis, is going to open the 53rd New York Film Festival. I guess it's held in late September. And The Walk is a film about Philippe Petit. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because he walked in between the Twin Towers. That's probably his most well-known feat, his well-known high wire act. He literally walked on a wire between those two buildings when they were standing in the 70s. I think it was 1974 he did that. And this is kind of the story of how he did that. Playing Philippe Petit is your favorite person, Michael.
He's a terrific actor.
Yes.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Oh, I thought you were going to say. And of course, people would know Philippe Petit and his story because it inspired a terrific documentary film called Man on Wire. That was back in 2008, right?
Yes. 2009, maybe?
Maybe it was released in the U.S. or whatever. Yeah. Okay. So they're probably familiar with the story about them sort of breaking into the Twin Towers, stringing up the wire across the two, and then doing it, you know, surprising everybody. It's kind of an amazing feat. And this film, you think, well, gee, they just told that story really, really well in Man on Wire. Why do it again? But they're using 3D. Did they shoot it in IMAX? I'm not sure. But they sort of have presented it as a heist movie and sort of in the spirit of some of the classic French heist films. There's going to be a lot of quiet stuff where they're breaking in. Again, they do the wire and you watch them actually do it and you get the sense of them really walking across the two towers. What a great use of 3D. I'm looking forward to it.
You know, just a complete, by the way, I saw some of this movie at CinemaCon. They showed some of it. I believe some of it was shot in IMAX. I could be wrong about that, but it looked amazing. And there were a lot of quiet moments in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the comments about this story and about the selection of The Walk for the New York Film Festival, which is kind of becoming, that opening night slot is kind of becoming a bit of a Oscar contender slot.
Well, everybody wants to have a big, you know, a big movie in there.
Yeah.
You know, in their opening night film, of course.
Yeah. But I went sailing recently, as you know, Michael. I bought this book on knots, and I thought, oh, this will be good for the kids because it tells the story of the knots and how the knots came to be. And
the story of the how the knots came to be? Sounds like the worst picture book ever.
Well, it was quite interesting. It was fascinating, the history of, like, the knot, of certain knots and how, the, you know, what they were used for historically. But then there are all these pictures of this guy tying knots for high wire acts. I'm like, what is the deal with this guy? Why is it that, you know, wait a second, who is this guy? Turns out it was Philippe Petit.
Okay.
He wrote this book called Why Not? It's not spelled K-N-O-T. But I loved the little thing that this, a commenter on the New York Times story on this, Stu Freeman, he says, any moment now, we'll get the announcement that the opening night tickets for the New York Film Festival will be priced at $60 each, $10 extra for the glasses.
Well, yeah, but he's saying more a point that the opening and closing night films are really about bringing in money rather than, you know, showing the movie to the world, because he says they really charge extra. But of course, the point is those movies are all going to be released shortly in theaters. And so when the general public is invited to see it at the festival, they're paying extra. They're paying a premium for the chance to see it early. And he's feeling like it's getting kind of ugly.
Well, but that's kind of what opening and closing nights are for anyway. Right.
Well, not really. Are they supposed to be moneymakers, or are they supposed to celebrate the festival and the movies that you're doing?
Well, I think a little bit of both.
Okay. Well, usually it's to say, hey, look, this is a big important film, not to say, here's Jurassic World and we can jam in people into our theater and charge extra. I don't know. They were celebrating Broadway last night, though, weren't they?
Yes, and they were doing it nowhere near. Well, I guess it's somewhat close to Broadway. It's Radio City Music Halls, where the 2015 Tony Awards were held, the 69th annual awards.
It's known as Broadway's not-so-big night.
Oh, really? Why is it not so big?
Well, because nobody watched. You know, Broadway set a record year in grosses and admissions. Broadway had a terrific year on the road. More people saw a Broadway show last year than ever before in history. Tons of people saw a Broadway show touring in their area. And yet, the broadcast opposite the NBA Finals, Broadway, did you not know the NBA Finals are on? You know, think about these things. Opposite the NBA Finals, it hit almost a record low. 6.3 million people watched, which is not a lot of people.
Right.
And if you take out Greenwich Village, you're down to like 4 million.
What you're saying is 2.3 million people in Greenwich Village were watching the Tonys last night.
That's right. Everybody in New York City watched because they go to Broadway a lot. You know, a third of the Broadway audience is in that area, the New York, New Jersey area. So you're asking people around the country to watch a show for shows that they'll never see for a lot of them. Maybe they've seen Wicked or they've seen The Lion King, but most of the shows they see celebrated on Broadway won't get to their area, or if they do, they're not going to see them. So the question is, you got to make a fun show for people who never go to Broadway or never get a chance to go or rarely get a chance. What kind of job did they do for you, Sperling? Was it a good show? I heard mostly boring.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't watch it, but quite honestly, I'm
in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
Not a hotbed of Broadway Tony watching.
Yeah, I almost didn't watch it myself. Quite frankly, I was like, oh, I really don't want to go through another award show. And it definitely was not great. It was
what was the best performance of the night? What performance on the show helped sell tickets? Because that's really where the money is. You win best musical or best revival of a musical or best play. Those are the awards that make you money. And if you have a really good performance on the show, even if you don't win, they say, oh, they had Finding Neverland on the show, wasn't nominated, but it had a nice performance and people go, oh, it's already a hit. And maybe they'll say, I want to see that show when I come to New York.
I would say Finding Neverland had a terrific performance. Kelsey Grammer was in it, and Matthew Morrison. I know I'm about to start getting names wrong, okay?
So did it make you say, gee, why wasn't that nominated?
It made
was
me
it that
say,
good?
Yeah. Well, yes, it made me say, why wasn't this nominated? Something Rotten actually had a very good performance. The King and I had an okay performance. You know, it's always great to see Kelly O'Hara, but other than that, it wasn't that great. An American in Paris was, I guess, okay.
And those were both medleys, by the way, which I have a big problem with. I think it's a total waste of time. You're doing what you do on a commercial, or what you could do online. What you should do on Broadway's Big Night is do a performance of a song, the big moment of the show that makes you go, wow, you know, and you don't get that when you string together three or four songs.
Well,
you don't
actually
get any emotional impact.
Finding Neverland, they did the act one closing number. That's it.
Right.
They didn't do a medley.
Same thing with Something Rotten. They did the big number of the show, which is a musical. It's the showstopper in act one. It's by far the best thing in the show. Most people thought act two wasn't that good. But boy, that was a fun number, just like the number in Aladdin from a year or two ago. That's the showstopper. They did it on the show and it hits, you know. And same thing with American in Paris. They did a medley of three or four little bits and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I agree. And I saw the, what was it, On the Town, I think, is which is a revival. That worked because they started in the audience, and even though it was a medley, that wound up working, actually.
Yeah, it's not that it can never work, but I think it's usually a missed opportunity. Why not have the big moment in the show where it's a full song, a full performance, you get that impact? You know, if you have to have a little talking, introducing it to set up the scene, fine. They did that with, Dreamgirls, and I'm telling you, I'm not going. When I looked at a clip recently for some reason, there was like a minute or two of talking and people setting up the scene so that you knew what was going on. And, it was like a 7-minute clip, of that performance. And I thought, well, that's awesome. They really took their time. But by God, it's one of the great moments in Tony history. So it was a good night for a couple shows. Curious Incident, of course. I should say the full title since you didn't. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime won Best Play and pretty much all the tech awards for a play. It also won Best Actor for Alex Sharp, who's at Juilliard, is dating a girl. So he's having a good time.
He's basically off the list now, right? I mean, because
he's off the list.
I'm surprised he was even allowed to enter Radio City Music Hall last night.
And Fun Home was the big winner for Best Musical.
Fun Home actually did have a performance. They did just one song. It got a rousing standing ovation because whoever the little girl is in that, she did the song. But I have to say, the whole time I thought, what the heck is going on here? What is this musical about? And what is she singing about? I've got no clue what's going on here. The whole thing seemed rather awkward unless you were an insider or in the venue. Or you'd seen the show. I had no idea what was going on, and that did not make me want to see that show at all.
I'd heard that was a really good performance. The actress you're talking about is Sydney Lucas. I was kind of rooting for her to win Best Supporting Actress. She was beaten by Ruthie Ann Miles, who won for The King and I, who was terrific. And she was in Here Lies Love, the David Byrne musical a few years ago. So she's a terrific talent as well. Three people from Fun Home were nominated in that category, and they probably just canceled each other out.
And that's when I saw that the woman from The King and I won, I went, oh, wait a second. I know exactly what just happened here. All these people from this Fun Home totally canceled each other, or that, it was kind of a vote split. And that's exactly what I think happened.
And the song she sang was Keys. I'm not sure what the name of the song is because they didn't give song titles in the show notes. But it's about a little girl who's with her dad at the grocery store, sort of. And she notices she's a young girl who doesn't really know she's a lesbian yet, but she is. And she notices a woman making a delivery, a sturdy woman wearing khakis and shipping and stuff, and she's strong, and the girl immediately identifies with her as like, oh my god, who is that? Not she's not attracted to her, she's just like, there is a powerful figure, I like her, I know her, I identify with her, and look at all those keys. And it's sort of a little lesbian stereotype joke shtick, and it's very funny in the show. It's the best song in the show. And I guess they didn't set it up enough well with a commentary about like what the scene is and who the little girl is. Did they not do that?
They tried, but it didn't come off as well as I thought it could. And maybe I'll go back and rewatch that moment, but it just seemed like...
Well, I'm sure if you were confused, most people were confused. If you haven't seen the show, it's hard. Usually songs are easier to do than scenes, from plays. For the plays, they just showed a couple clips. But musicals are usually a little easier to set up if you're doing a song. This is just a song. You can usually just enjoy the song in and of itself, even if you don't know what the context is. But I guess they didn't do a good job there. But they certainly did good at the Tonys. They won almost everything in sight. And I was wrong on a lot of the big awards. I was voting with my head rather than my heart. Almost pretty much everything won that I would have voted for. So even though I was wrong thinking that American in Paris would win Best Musical, if I was voting, I probably would have voted for Fun Home. I didn't like any of the musicals that were nominated, but that was the one I thought had the most interesting stuff going on. Even though I didn't think it was successful, I thought it was better than the others.
Well, now Fun Home and Hamilton, which wasn't nominated because it didn't go to Broadway yet.
It opens in July. It starts previews in July and opens in August.
Right.
Of course it wasn't nominated.
Right. There's a point why I link these two, and that's because they both kind of workshopped and were started at the public theater there in New York, which is becoming quite the little hotbed of, new shows.
Well, you know, everybody gets their moments. You know, the people, they're on a good run. Before that, it was the New York Theater Workshop. They had Once, and they had Finding Neverland, but the other Peter Pan inspired musical, Bloody Hell. I can't remember the name.
Oh, that was Peter and the Star Catcher.
Yeah, that's a play, not a musical. But yes, that was very fun. So yeah, those things come and they tend to clump together for some reason. You just get a little heat for a moment. But yeah, the public has had a long history of incubating work. Stu's Passing Strange 10 or so years ago. Now this stuff. So yeah.
And it looks like
a good night for them.
And it looks like, you know, Where the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, the National Theatre of London, looks like they're kind of on the rise as well.
I wouldn't say they're on the rise. No, they always have a lot of great shows. They dominate the Olivier's year after year. They had Matilda a year or two ago. But yeah, no, they're always providing terrific shows. So, you know, that's just a standard. But the public, though, as they pointed out, they said, don't think that this means we're going to be awash in money, because they took a Chorus Line to Broadway, which was a huge risk. And that basically funded the public for the next 10 to 20 years, because it was so unusual to transfer a show like that. And the deal they got, when everybody thought, well, this is never going to work, was such that they just made tons of money at the box office. These shows now are all being created and developed with tons of backers and people who know that it's going to go to Broadway, or they want to go to Broadway, or they're going to make a commercial transfer. So the public gets a little piece of the action, but nowhere near what they would have gotten 20 years ago or 30, 40 years ago, when no one expected anything of the work that they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at say Fun Home, there's a show that might not actually make it out of New York.
It's going to tour now.
Exactly. Whereas An American in Paris, I feel like that's going to make it to the Amundsen here in LA, and to San Francisco, and to Dallas, and Chicago, just because it's got the name brand recognition. Something Rotten, same thing. But I don't necessarily.
What's the name brand recognition of Something Rotten?
Shakespeare.
It's
about Shakespeare.
Okay. It's about Shakespeare. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, now, mind you, you talked about musicals and a big number that's going to make you want to go see a musical. Certainly a clip that made me want to see this play, and I'm surprised this person just from the clip alone didn't win, was Hand to God. This is about some character that has like a dual personality, and one of the personalities is the puppet on his arm. It's remarkable.
No. It depends on your point of view. It's about a kid who does hand puppetry to celebrate to spread the word of Jesus. You know, they do puppetry to teach other kids about Jesus and stories from the Bible. And his hand puppet, becomes possessed by the devil.
Ah, okay. The
that
clip
may or may not be what's actually happening, but that's the premise of the show. This is on Broadway now. Even going to Broadway was a big risk for this show. I saw it off-Broadway. I saw it off-Broadway. It stars Stephen Boyer, who is terrific. I'm so glad he got a Tony nomination. If Alex Sharp had not won for The Curious Incident, it would have been Stephen Boyer. So it's a great performance. The show is a little problematic, but it's a lot of fun. If you like black humor and you're not easily scandalized and you're not easily offended, you know, put that out there. You got to make sure you're not easily offended, because it is a sacrilegious show, certainly, to say the least. And but it's, you know, it's not going to shock and offend you unless you're easily shocked and offended.
Well, we're talking about best performance by a leading actor in a play, which Bradley Cooper, movie star Bradley Cooper, was up for The Elephant Man. He played John Merrick, and there was some talk that maybe he might, but not against Alex Sharp and Stephen Boyer. So, you know, Bradley Cooper, always the groomsman, whereas on the other side of the aisle, best performance by a leading actress in a play, the movie star won. Helen Mirren won, playing Queen Elizabeth II, a role she's never performed before. She, of course, I'm joking. She won for The Audience.
That's right. So that was almost a given. That was one of the performances. I should say that's one of the awards. We sort of knew who was going to win. Best Revival of a Musical was clearly going to be The King and I. Kelly O'Hara for Best Actress was not so clear-cut. That was between her and Kristen Chenoweth. That was a nail-biter. Kelly O'Hara finally won after 5 or 6 nominations, however many it was. She finally won her first Tony. Kristen has won already for You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. So it was a good night. Fun Home needed the win for Best Musical more than any other show, certainly. Something Rotten and American in Paris are already commercial hits. Fun Home is a commercial hit too, though how long its legs will be, we don't know. But it's certainly been packing them in so far, and maybe this will be the thing to put it over the top.
Well, and Alan Cumming and Kristen Chenoweth, who were co-hosting the show, they opened the show and they mentioned a couple of people who were nominated but not there, or not nominated and not there. And then there was the person who wasn't nominated yet still managed to show up, which was Harvey Weinstein for Finding Neverland. And Alan Cumming turned to Harvey Weinstein, and who's sitting in the audience next to Anna Wintour from Vogue, believe it or not. And
she clothed a lot of people on the runway, et cetera.
Yes.
So.
Alan Cumming turned to him and said, "Don't worry, you can console yourself with the $1 million plus per week gross you've been getting, because that show has done quite well financially."
Yeah, that's been a hit from day one. Well, yeah, it's been a hit from day one with audiences. So you're talking about Finding Neverland, a musical about the making of Peter Pan, and that's been a hit. And so he's happy.
Well, and Kelly O'Hara, I just want to mention her one more time, only because her acceptance speech was probably the highlight of all the acceptance speeches. She was so happy to win, and just the way she accepted everything. She didn't have a speech prepared. She just was, it was so genuine and true. And she literally danced off the stage.
Well, and you know, the nice thing is you didn't see that speech 17 times before the way you do for the Oscars. That's one reason why the Tonys are a little fresher. There is an award season. There are other awards given out, but they're quick. They're brief. They're not as many. They don't get televised. And so unless you're in the industry, you're not watching her try and figure out how to say thank you in a different way for the 10th different time.
You mentioned those other award ceremonies, which are quick and brief. Well, guess what? We actually have a whole segment of news stories that are quick and brief. Did you know that?
What's it called?
It's called Big Deal or Big Whoop. It's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Showtime, because Showtime is going over the top, baby. OTT. That makes them sound like soldiers in World War One, doesn't it?
But not when you say OTT, baby, and make it sound like hip hop. But yeah.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was trying to do there, actually. So thank you for acknowledging that I succeeded, because apparently I did not succeed in saying the name of Emma Stone's.
Don't do it.
Okay. Oh, okay. But, you know, here's the thing. In fact, Showtime, it's the latest skirmish in the war for eyeballs between Showtime, HBO, and these premium cable networks. Seemingly every TV channel will be available over the top someday soon. The premium cable channel Showtime launches in mid-July and will be available on all Apple devices and their website, not just Apple TV, the way HBO is right now. They're going to be on Apple as well as Roku and PlayStation. It will cost about $11 a month, or exactly $11 per month. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Big whoop. Okay, well, it's, I
you
guess,
know why? Because all I want to know is, why hasn't everybody announced their over-the-top service?
Well, I can tell you that it's a very brief answer, and it is because they don't want to upset the MSOs. However, now that HBO has done it, it has opened the floodgates.
Yeah, right. And CBS has it, and now other people have it. Everybody's going to do it.
Yeah,
get it done.
The floodgate, now basically it's the networks turning to the MSOs, the cable operators, and saying, look, it's not that we want to do this, but we have to. So we don't want to ruin our gravy train here, but if we don't do something, we as a business are going to go away. So
that's right. And consumers can get rid of their stupid cable bill for paying for 500 channels, most of which they never watch, and they can get just their favorite 10 or 20 channels and will only cost them $270 a month.
That's
right. Enjoy.
Yeah. So wait, what? Wait, I'm doing a little math here. You said $150. $270 is way more and I'm getting way less. I don't understand.
Keep going.
Well, my question, Michael, can I get an amen?
Amen.
Disney is rebooting one of its biggest hit comedies with the hot writing team of Kiwi Smith and Karen McCullough. They're tackling the remake of Whoopi Goldberg's hit Sister Act. Can I get a hallelujah?
No.
Okay. No one knows what exactly is planned for the reboot, a sequel, or, you know, what and will Whoopi be in it. Nobody knows any of that yet. All they're saying is Sister Act. You know, another one of those. In other words, business as usual for Hollywood. They're remaking a hit film from the past. Big deal or big whoop?
The definition of a big whoop.
Oh, okay.
You know, they had the hit film in 92. They had the sequel in 93, which was a big flop. You know, if they've got a fresh idea, great. But since they're not even telling us what the idea is other than to do it, you know, how are we supposed to react to that?
Yeah, you know, I was working with Disney at the time of Sister Act, the first film. And
I remember that picture of you in The Habit that you had.
Yeah, you know, when Whoopi couldn't be there I was in The Habit. I didn't make a habit of it, though. Get it? Didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, they were kind of nervous. Like, is this, kind of a movie about nuns? Is this going to be any good? Is this going to play? And I went to see the film, and I thought, this is a really fun, good movie. You got Whoopi Goldberg, who's off of an Oscar win. Yeah, this is going to do quite well. And sure enough, it did quite well. Not that, you know, I am some, you know, prophet, but it was pretty obvious once you saw the film.
turned into a Broadway show that was a flop.
Yes, that was also probably pretty obvious.
That made sense. You know, it's basically a musical to begin with. It could have worked. It just wasn't any good.
Yeah, I want to say what was also kind of obvious was last year, remember, we talked about a whole bunch of sexual abuse scandals, and we kind of had a few raised eyebrows at the time.
No, I would say I was more hard on the people who were involved rather than on the guy.
Okay, well,
so I would say I have more to apologizing and backtracking to do than you do, perhaps.
Okay, well,
tell us what we're talking about.
We're talking about Michael Egan, who is the man who accused some major Hollywood figures of sexual abuse of varying kinds. He has now pled guilty to fraud charges in an unrelated case and awaits sentencing in North Carolina. His lawyers have apologized to two of the people who were accused, saying they know now the allegations were indeed false. Those two executives are Garth Ansier and David Newman. But instead of apologizing and simply saying they were duped as well, according to Ansier's people, they will be paying a sum in the quote-unquote seven figures. Newman's folks say he, too, will be compensated. Director Brian Singer and a fourth accused, Gary Goddard, were not mentioned in these mea culpas, presumably because they had not countersued, whereas David Newman and Garth Ansier had both countersued, which is why, actually, there is a monetary settlement here. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal.
I agree.
I don't know if it can repair the reputation. Once you get tarred with that, it's very hard to step away from it. As I said at the time, hey, these guys were linked to a group and a person who was convicted what was he convicted of? I shouldn't say. Let's to be specific.
Well, wasn't
the guy fled the country for having sex with a minor, you know?
That Garth Ansier? Wasn't he and I could be wrong. So I should probably,
Garth Ansier never fled the country.
Okay. I'm wrong. I take it back.
No, it was somebody else.
Yeah, I take it back.
No, it was the guy with the house and the blah, blah, blah. And the stories we've been hearing for 20 years about the antics that went on there when they were all involved in the 90s and all hanging out together. So they were involved with a bad person who did terrible things and fled the country and admitted guilt. So, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And this guy's story contradicted what he said 20 years ago when they accused the other guy. And, you know, he had to flee the country. But I said, well, you know what? You get talked into saying things when you're a young person and vulnerable and, you know, accusing one person. No, nobody else did anything. You know, these things happen. And I gave Michael Egan all sorts of rope. And clearly I was wrong.
Well, and I believe Mark Collins Rector is the person that I was referring to.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so my apologies to Garth Ansier.
Never fled the country.
Who never fled the country, and like his lawyers, I now must apologize. Thankfully, he did not sue me, and I don't owe him a seven-figure salary.
Well, that's a seven-figure fee. That is a lot of money, isn't it?
Fee.
That's really to help take care of the lawyers so they don't have to pay any money, I assume?
Yes.
Once you get rid of the lawyers, that's pretty much going to be gone.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly what that's for. It's like, hey, you sued me. You cost me all this money. Guess what? You're going to pay me back and get what my real reward here is. You're going to publicly apologize in a major way, which they did.
Yep.
Now, the main lobbying group for Hollywood is the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA. We talk about them all the time. And they like one thing. Well, they like many things, but they really do like stability. Its chairman and CEO is former Senator Chris Dodd. He joined in 2011, and they've just extended his deal through 2018. One of his predecessors, Jack Valenti, held the post for 38 years. In fact, I think he created the post, although I could be wrong about that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, actually, because he has not had a great tenure.
Well, he hasn't had a horrible tenure either. I mean, Dan Glickman had a worse tenure right before him. You know, he was there for like 4 or 5 years, Dan Glickman, the former congressman. He didn't, you know, he was kind of seen as ineffective. Chris Dodd has been seen as a little bit more effective as that.
And I think they're acknowledging that they have conflicting desires, that these big multinational corporations aren't always on the same page. So you're asking them to represent people who don't agree.
Yes.
And so the problems that he's had have been because of that, not because of how he did his job. And I think they're saying, yeah, we recognize that. You're doing a good job. We're not always on the same page. So you can't conceivably make everybody happy, but you're doing a good enough job and we want you to stick around.
You know, the one thing that Chris Dodd has found that all of the studios can agree on is the fact that they don't agree on anything. In fact, you might recall the Sony hack, you know, he was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know,
he did a bad job on that.
Yeah. Well,
there was no confusion there. There was no reason all the studios should not have spoken out strongly and said that was wrong and terrible. And show, you know, there should have been no schadenfreude whatsoever. They should have immediately and strongly spoken out and said, and they all now realize that there's nobody who said, oh, that was no big deal. they all realized how terrible that was and it could happen to them. And they did not step to the plate and represent the industry the way they should have. That, to me, was his biggest failing. But since it was reflected by all the other studios as well, who weren't speaking out loudly, then you know, he gets a pass.
And he wound up getting the money from China. But now, what do you make of this new documentary that's being done on the Sony?
He got the money from China.
Well, you know, he basically negotiated the Chinese distributors weren't paying the Hollywood distributors their box office because of the dispute between the percentages.
That's right. They resolved that crisis. The money was being held in a third party account until everybody agreed on what was going on, right?
Right. Yes, and he helped resolve that.
China's big.
Yes. North Korea is small, but apparently there's some question now from some documentary filmmakers whether they were actually indeed behind the Sony hack. What do you make of this? This is the Oscar nominated team that did The Square a couple years ago, was nominated for an Oscar. They're doing a documentary on the Sony hack, and they say expect some bombshells.
Oh, please. Why are we teasing a film that hasn't even been made yet?
I guess that's a big whoop.
Well, they've got some revelations that we may hear about 5 years from now. Well, thank you. Okay.
Well, you know what? Actor Bruce Willis better brush up on his Mandarin, or should I say, he should learn how to say... We are now considered explicit material in China.
Well, what is that? What did you just have? What did they say?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother. Well, you can.
Heavens to Betsy. Okay.
Yes, in simplified Chinese. I wonder.
That's his catchphrase from Die Hard. Why are we saying this? Why does he need to brush up on his Mandarin?
Well, he's just signed on for an 8-day cameo in the new Chinese language epic, The Bombing. Willis has a small role as an American in the midst of this tale of Chinese endurance during the endless aerial bombardment during World War II, specifically the city of Chongqing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'd kind of say it's a big whoop because he hasn't had a movie in ages. So doing it, you know, I mean, he had Good Day to Die Hard in 2013, but he had Looper, which got pretty good reviews and has my friend Joseph Gordon-Levitt in it. But he hasn't had a really... you know, good movie where that he starred in or had a good role in, I think, since Red, really. And that's, you know, just a commercial hit with about 10 other big elderly stars. So, you know, it's been ages since he's so going to China, going to Japan to get some work. That seems, you know, and it's a cameo, a glorified cameo. So I think it's pretty much a big whoop. But he can, you know, he can probably rule out doing any Japanese commercial endorsements anytime soon, right?
That's probably true.
Making a movie about Japan bombing atrocities during World War II is not going to get you a lot of deals in the House of the Rising Sun.
Well, you know, I think that that Bruce Willis these days, that's kind of his M.O. He shows up and does cameos and gets
a... Well, I'm sure he'd be happy to do a good role if he had one.
Yeah, although he apparently got... what was the Expendables? He was going to show up for 3 days and he wanted... Or a day and he wanted $3 million and they said, no, we're not going to pay... You know, this is a cameo. You're not going to... And so that's kind of what he's been doing these days. He just does...
Well, he's got a role in the new Woody Allen movie.
Okay.
He's got 5 or 6 movies in pre or post-production announced happening. So, you know, he's got a role in the next Woody Allen that's due out 2016. Maybe that'll be the film to turn it around for him.
In yet another example of the endless merging in the entertainment industry, the Dish Network is looking to merge with T-Mobile. Bigger is better, but not so much bigger that your deal gets blocked, apparently. This one should clear that hurdle if it happens. Regulatory hurdle, of course, is what we're speaking of. Is it a big deal or a big whoop that these two companies should be merging?
I guess it's a big whoop. It's gonna happen, right? It's a satellite company and a telecommunications company merging together. That's what everybody's doing. Is there anything new here? Is there any reason why, you know, we're so used to saying, well, the massive Blockbuster deal fell apart. That was such a shock. Pretty much every other deal gets approved. So I don't think there's any question this one will. Whether or not it's good for the consumers, I don't know.
The iconic Canadian teen drama is finally graduating. Of course, we're talking about Degrassi, the latest iteration of the fame launching pad for young talent and button-pushing episodes about controversial issues. Degrassi is taking its final bow this July. Its most famous graduate is rapper Drake, but there have been many more, as well as songs and trends and a safe place where teens got their soap fix along with an after-school special vibe whenever an issue like bullying, coming out, guns in school, and other similar plot points popped up. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, I think it's a big deal.
I do, too. I was surprised that more wasn't made of this.
Yeah, you know, Degrassi's a fixture. You know, Degrassi's been on the air so long, I guess they're just sort of taking it for granted. But, you know, it's had a long, long run. It had a new generation and followed some to adulthood. You know, it's had spinoffs and everything. It will come back again because this version is a reboot of the original series. So, you know, it's not the end of Degrassi, but it is the end of Degrassi for now.
Yeah, I felt the announcing of the end of this version of Degrassi kind of, I don't want to say mirrored, but felt the same way as when I kept telling people, hey, there's a Triple Crown winner. They won all three races. People were like, what? There was a horse racing for the Triple Crown? I didn't even know that. How come I didn't know that? It's like,
well, I knew that.
Yeah, I mean, but there were so many people who I would have expected to know that didn't. It was like, how come this isn't a bigger deal? Why? I mean, it's on the front page of newspapers, but yet nobody's talking about it. Okay. You know what nobody else is talking about? The fact that Netflix is once again going to another country. In fact, Netflix is very popular in Spain, even though it's not available there yet. So pirates beware, Netflix is launching in Spain this October. It will cost about €8 a month and won't include House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, since both of those shows are on Canal Plus in that territory. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's part of their plan. We've seen this strategy before. My question is, do you think they're going to find that they don't necessarily want to make all their U.S. shows available on Netflix once they can? Maybe they'll find that they'd launch a new show. Will it be automatic that it becomes available on Netflix in Spain and every other territory? Or will they still look at it and say, gee, maybe this I should sell this? You know, it'll be like ABC or CBS producing a show, and it doesn't always go on their network.
You know what? You know? They're going to go where the money is. That they're going to follow the money. And right now the money, well, before the money was in selling the show because they didn't have a, you know, an outlet that they controlled in any of those territories. So it didn't matter that they sold it in France or they sold it in Spain, which is exactly what Netflix did. But now that they actually can control that, they want to attract people to their subscription service. So even if they take a little bit of a loss on the actual production of the content, it doesn't matter if people are coming to Netflix and paying the $8 a month over and over and over again because they want to see that, you know, that they'll keep it.
But the question is just whether they look at, say, the new Jane Fonda Lily Tomlin comedy and say, do I need to automatically put this on Netflix in another territory, or will this show be more valuable to us if I sell it and get it on broadcast TV and get a wider audience? You know, is that going to be a really big draw to people in France to see that show?
Well,
you know,
I think
they're creating their local language programming. That obviously will be, they're creating programming for France. They'll create programming for Spain specifically, and that clearly will be on the local Netflix iteration. And then the question is, do we sell that in, you know, to some third broadcaster for North America, and in Spain and Mexico and other countries in Central and South America, do we sell it to somebody else, or is it more valuable for us to bring in viewers, blah blah. I think it's just not straightforward that once you have your network in that country, you're going to automatically place every show on that channel.
Well, and I think the answer to that question changes over time. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, right now, two things are taking place. One is MIDM, okay, over in Cannes, France. So the Cannes Film Festival moves out of the Palais, and MIDM, a music industry conference, moves in. And yesterday at that conference, you had Sony Music CEO Doug Morris kind of giving a lifetime career talk. It was kind of an interview on stage about his wide-ranging career. And he said, yeah, you know, the whole music service thing that Apple is talking about is happening tomorrow. He just kind of he said, what are you going to do? Sue me. I'm old.
I just checked the live updates, and they still haven't given us more information about that. So we don't know exactly any new details other than what we expect about their streaming music service. They did announce a new version of OS X, which they have dubbed El Capitan, which the Times thought was strange. But to me, I immediately thought, yep, Central and South, you know, that's a big territory in the world. You know, it's a big market in here in North America, the Spanish-speaking Hispanic and Latino community. It's a big market all over the world. And they've gone from animals to El Capitan, and I think that's sort of a tip of the hat to that.
Actually, I think they are going with they're going with surfing spots in California.
Oh, that too, yeah. And so they've got a lot of other news.
I take that back. Yosemite, El Capitan is in Yosemite, so that's what they're doing.
Okay. All right. So the next one will be Old Faithful.
Or Half Dome.
All right, so they're announcing their stuff. I guess we'll know more next week because we can't detail exactly what they're doing until they make it official.
That's true. But now, what do you make of this? You know, because a lot has been...
It's like CNN. Why should the fact that we have no information stop us from talking about it?
But, well, this is my question for you. I mean, and it's a question whether it's Apple or somebody else, and maybe it's a question that only because it's Apple, it will... what Doug Morris said could be more accurate or more appropriate. He's saying, what does Apple bring to this? Well, they've got $178 billion in the bank, and they have 800 million credit cards in iTunes. Spotify has never really advertised because it's never been profitable. My guess is that Apple will promote this like crazy, and I think that will have a halo effect on the streaming business. A rising tide will lift all boats. It's the beginning of an amazing moment for our industry. He's really seeing this moment as a quote-unquote tipping point for streaming music, which could help save the industry. Do you think that Apple getting into this space so late, in fact, that they actually could serve as a tipping point for music streaming?
Well, it's already pretty damn mainstream, isn't it? It's a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah, but I suppose...
It is mainstream. If you're making billions of dollars, aren't you? I mean, that's like saying they're going to make video games mainstream just because you don't play video games. It's a multi-billion dollar business. So, I mean, it is already successful. I think they can reach more people. If they can change the terms and start getting more money to the artist, that is where you'll make a difference. But, you know, it's here, clearly. I don't think the industry needs saving. I think they've stabilized where they are. They've stopped the bleeding, and now they're starting to grow again via streaming services and other stuff and refocusing on touring and things like that. So can they grow it back to be where it was in its heyday? I don't know about that. I don't think so.
Well, through
pricing,
I think
it's more about changing where the dollars are spent.
Well, and PricewaterhouseCoopers had a survey recently that said that the music industry will continue to lose money into 2019. That was their report.
Who said they're losing money? They're not losing money. They mean make less money than they did last year. Is that what they mean?
Yes.
Yeah, they're not losing money. They're making billions of dollars.
Right, but I guess, you know, the billions of dollars that they're making are going in the wrong direction, I suppose. That's I didn't read the report, so that's why
they're making then why stop talking about it then? Yeah, so
We don't know
they're never going to make what they made, you know, 20 years ago when you had the transition from cassettes and LPs to CDs. That'll never happen again. When they had multi-blockbuster albums that sold 10, 15 million copies without blinking an eye. Every Garth Brooks album sold 8-9 million copies. It was just, you know, it was a crazy heyday for the business. And people suddenly rebought all their albums that they owned for 20 years. They bought them again on CD. That's never going to happen.
Yes, but, you know, one thing that will probably not happen again for some time is the 3D share of box office hitting like 75 to 90%. Remember when
on opening weekend.
On opening weekend. And that is what our listener email is about this week. We kind of teased it last week that CJ Flynn of Digital Test Tools had sent us an email. Michael, do you want to read this or how do you want to work this?
Well, he's slapping me around, so I think you should read it.
Okay. Well, he says, hi, guys. I must say that it was a pleasure when there were 2 weeks of not hearing Michael rant on 3D. Well, guess what? That vacation is over, apparently, CJ, because we just spent the last 2 weeks ranting against 3D. Granted, one was a week without a show. So, okay, that was a couple weeks
ago.
But there was actually a whole 2 weeks of podcasts when I didn't have to hear him bang on that tired and out of tune drum. Case in point from last week, to gloat that a 45% 3D Ultron audience reading is proving that a failed idea is headed to oblivion, I want to point out that 40% of any market is pretty good pickings in most people's book, and 40% of a $1.5 billion movie is not something that should be so easily scoffed at without challenge. There are indeed a bunch of reasons that the current 3D technology is not serving the customers well or as good as it should be, and I would probably be in the camp that says that it was prematurely put on the market. But it is a much more complicated issue than just that. An example is the specious idea that you should draw the line at quote-unquote captured with 3D or quote-unquote created 3D in post to define well-done and not-so-well-done 3D work. If you want things to natter about against 3D, I can send you a list, but pick your battles better, please.
Please, send us a list. Keep going.
Oh, do you want me to finish this off here?
Yeah.
He goes on to say, as long as I am ranting, I also take issue with your reaction to paying more for technology advancements, which you feel should be getting quote-unquote better in the first place. At the risk of losing my anti-capitalist cred, please consider that there is always a compromise in every engineering endeavor, choosing the acceptable compromise that can be produced to give acceptable quality at an acceptable price, or choosing the compromises that get that gets closer to whatever perfection that this generation of technology can give usually involves expensive personnel and expensive iterations of silicone and hardware and software versions and testing and experiments in survival mode the whole time. Then, when it is finally ready, and this is the technology we're talking about here, and when it's finally ready for prime time, it costs far, far more than the standard to deliver, especially for the first couple of years. Until society and its finances are structured differently, that just means higher ticket prices for the extra darkness and colors and light levels of the Dolby Vision system, which in my mind is something extraordinary indeed. And then in parentheses, he writes, Sperling touched on it, but my two cents is that this is the first technology that I walked away from that made me look at reality differently.
Reality, wow.
Yeah, well, because all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I guess there are all these colors in reality. Now he goes on to say, does that mean I am ready to pay $26 a person for Tomorrowland? Ha! Not a chance after hearing the reviews you gave it. I would never argue with your reviews of artistry. Would I have paid for HDR for Gravity? If they remastered it and played it at the El Capitan, I'd stand in line tomorrow for tickets. In the 3D line. Best CJ.
Maybe Apple is naming their new operating system after a film theater.
Yeah, I
know. Maybe it's after the El Capitan.
Now, that would be news.
That's actually close.
Yeah. Now, and James Gardner from Australia, from Digital and Cinetech Geek, he weighed in with a very brief email just really saying, hey, guys.
I'll read this one. Hey, guys, I was interested to hear the 3D percent for San Andreas. 40% was the number that it came in at. Wow. It's in its second week here now, and look at the attached image. Crown is one of the busiest cinemas in Melbourne. Note, the 2D version is only listed. I did see one per day 3D session the first week. 3D is not doing well in Australia, from my experience. Sperling, have a look at your local cinema session times. What percent do they show? Just wondering how it compares to the percent mentioned above.
Yeah.
So and did you do that? What did
he's absolutely
he's
right.
He's saying after opening weekend and after opening week, when you look at what is actually being shown and what you can see, they're not showing a lot of screenings for 3D because people aren't interested.
Well, it's not only that. It's that the studios don't want to keep paying for the glasses in certain territories. Now, they don't pay for them in all territories, but in certain territories like North America.
And there isn't the demand.
Right. And quite honestly, yes, the 3D showings do drop off quite substantially. Even in the first week, I've noticed that really there's maybe 25-30% of the screenings or showtimes or sessions are in 3D. That's it. So to reach 40% of if that's true, if I would be interested to know what the percentage of 3D versus 2D screenings were, then looking at what the percentage of the box office was. He's absolutely right about that.
So I'm looking at in Birmingham, Alabama on a Monday. That's as slow a day of a week as it gets, really. San Andreas is showing equally in 3D and 2D. It's on two screens at one local cinema. It's the big local cinema. Tomorrowland is only available in 2D. Mad Max Fury Road is only available in 2D. Avengers Age of Ultron is only available in 2D. So those movies have been out for a while. San Andreas is the big movie right now, and 50% of the screenings here are in 3D. That's just one theater in one location, but you can see none of the others are, so that's kind of telling. So when he talks about having 40% of the market or 40% of the movie of the Avengers Age of Ultron is in 3D, it's not. We're talking about opening weekend is 3D, and we're just trying to keep it in context that 5 or 10 years ago, we were being told every movie was going to be released in 3D. And opening weekends were 70, 80, 90% of the box office sometimes. They were way up there. So now we're finding not a lot of movies are in 3D. Not every single movie, just big, fat summer blockbuster type movies. And their 3D audience is really getting paid out after the first weekend or two. So, you know, we're just trying to keep in perspective. I'll try not to be so boring about it. I like 3D technology. I'm looking forward to the walk. I'm interested about this Ultra Vision. Is that what it's called?
Dolby Vision.
Dolby Vision, you know,
and that's Dolby's Dolby's flavor of what's called high dynamic range. More colors, brighter colors, darker darks, darker blacks, whiter whites. It's kind of expanding the color gamut.
And what happened to high frame rate? Is that are more movies being shot in high frame rate? Did the Hobbit disaster, the first movie looking so weird and people not being ready to adjust to it, did that sort of stymie that, or is that still happening? What's going on there?
I think that it kind of did, frankly. I think a lot of people shied away from it after that kind of debacle and the way that looked.
Is Cameron not shooting in a higher frame rate?
He will shoot in a higher frame rate, and if there's somebody that can make a higher frame rate work and look good, it very well might be him. And we're talking about James Cameron, Avatar, remember.
Yeah, so it's not. It is really slowing down. There is not that big push. More and more directors are not saying they want to shoot in a high frame rate.
Pretty much, yeah. There's also some standards issues and whether the theaters can actually show it in a high frame rate and there's.
They need more new equipment.
Exactly.
They're like, really? Because they would all need to get new equipment to show something in Dolby Vision, right?
That is correct, yes.
Wow. Okay. So I'll try to be not such a bore. We appreciate your writing. I probably should have said
that you can write to us, actually. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email
Absolutely.
Address.
Absolutely. What if they want to call us?
Well, they can call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Toll free. In fact, emails are free too. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. All of that's free. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can also find ways to subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, and if you can't, let us know, and we'll make sure we get listed on whatever podcast aggregator you like to use. And please do subscribe to the show, rate and review us. We like reading the reviews, and it does help us out. Again, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can also find ways to contact us, as I've mentioned, ways to subscribe to us, ways to follow us. On Twitter, our handle is @showbizsandbox. On Facebook, if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you'll find our page. You can like us there. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website where they can be found. It is whoismgmt.com, all one word, obviously. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I'm not in 3D, but I do need a diet.com.
Okay. Wow. That was it. That one you pulled out pretty, that's pretty good, actually. I don't even know how to better that one other than to say that if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post. Of course, you can always find him on bookfilter.com where he's rating and reviewing books. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.